And I'd like to press you a little bit more on this issue of public-private cooperation. You started talking about it, and then you did get into what I'd been underlining in my notes, which was on the issue of how. It seems to me there are maybe three real impediments. One is so much of this comes from intelligence. We see that especially here. The United States government has Treasury Intel, the only finance ministry with its own intelligence component, as you're well aware. So we're using this information a lot. How we communicate that to the private sector beyond the one-off is, to me, very difficult. Having been involved in this on the inside and participating in some of those one-offs are it's very difficult even to get to that point when you want to share it. As we have, for example, in the case of Iran, we've shared some very useful declassified information, but that was a very long and complicated process. Second thing, it seems to me, is there are some confidentiality, perhaps privacy issues below the threshold of intelligence that may also come into play. And then third, I thought of this several times when you were talking, I wonder what the lawyers say, especially in this last case, for example. I could imagine there are lawyers who are concerned with, you know, it coming out that, yes, I shut down your accounts, but then it turns out that I bad-mouthed you to the rest of the financial community. I imagine that there are lawyers who are concerned about that, too. So I completely agree with you that we need to improve the public-private information sharing, and, of course, also the private-private, but you can speak that better than I can. What more can you say about how to do that? And really here I feel like I can ask this question because you were on the other side. You know what that's like.
Well, I think it's the multi-billion dollar question because a lot of people's response is it can't be done. And I'm not saying it's easily done. I think, though, 314B does provide a level of protection to institutions that are exchanging information. And it's been a while since I've looked at the exact wording of that. Carrie probably spends time advising people, but I think it gives you a level of protection with respect to the kind of information you can share. But even more than that, my sense is for institutions sharing information, you don't have to say a lot. If you did an analysis of a client and had a problem with that client, and you just alert an institution down the road that client used to be at your institution and it's coming to their institution, they're going to take a hard look and should be able to see what you see. Now, what I'd love to be able to do is send the third-party report on that client along with that phone call. And I suspect there are certain privacy or liability issues. But again, 314B, I think, was intended to address that. And I suspect if we look at it, and maybe it requires an adjustment to the regs, or maybe it requires a clarification of the statute. I don't even know that that's the case, because I don't think institutions have seriously tried to take advantage of it to share that kind of information. Now, I think 314A similarly provides the same kind of protection to the government and institutions in terms of sharing information. I recognize that sources and methods are very sensitive, and in fact, even within the government, sometimes people are reluctant to tell each other what they know. But what I can tell you is if the government can't decide to take that risk, don't count on getting a lot of assistance. So the government's going to have to do its own cost-benefit analysis in terms of how much risk is there. If you really establish vetted units, I don't think you have to tell the world. You can clear, just like you clear people in the government, you can clear people in the private sector, and there are, you know, certainly we look at defense contractors and others who are working on the most sensitive things that our government works on, and they're in the private sector, and they're cleared, and there are ways that we've designed ways to deal with that. I think the notion that you can't share financial information with the private sector is akin to saying that the government better, you know, start building its own weapons and airplanes, and that you can't use accounting firms and consulting firms to come into the intelligence community to do the kind of work they do. I think every day we see examples of private sector individuals who are highly cleared, doing highly sensitive work. And what law enforcement and I think the Treasury and others doing financial intelligence have to do is look to that model and accept that it's time to begin to do something like that on the financial side.
Thanks. Let's open to questions.
Okay. Susan Becker, IMF. Thank you so much for the fascinating presentation. Could you comment in your former hat or your current hat on the kind of cooperation that we found from the European Central Bank, ECB, and the BIS? Or any?
Well, it depends. When I was at OFAC, I don't think OFAC is well liked by the European community. So, in fact, I think I remember... let me put it this way.
You can take up the qualifiers.
Yeah. let me put it this way. When OFAC joined the Federal Reserve in its enforcement action against ABN AMRO, you will notice that there's a document that had the Dutch regulator's signature on it, but no OFAC signature on it. And there's a document that has an OFAC signature on it and no Dutch regulator's signature on it. FinCEN, different story, because and I think that that's improving now as Egmont has gotten more members. They're developing protocols to share information. I think that that's becoming a better way to share information. Having said that, the more FinCEN is perceived as assisting OFAC and the Treasury in unilateral sanctions, the less trust there is. That's going to damage FinCEN's ability to cooperatively share information with its counterparts.
I'd argue that the inclusion of a Syrian FIU into Egmont has already done enough to undermine Egmont for a little bit. Yes?
Marty Weiss at the Congressional Research Service.
I'm sorry, could you speak into the mic?
Oh,
thanks.
Martin Weiss with the Congressional Research Service. Just wanted to know what areas you think, that Congress is not, that you would like to see Congress take a more closer look at, whether it's foreign cooperation or kind of the overall policy structure between, what Treasury is trying to do versus what looking at, the overall foreign policy relationship with the State Department. So what, if there was three or four areas that you would like to see Congress, take a closer look at, what would they be?
I think the first area Congress could really assist this effort in would be to look at to the extent that the regulators feel like they've got to go in with checklists and demand certain processes, and to the extent the private sector feels that they need to make sure that they're hitting all those processes and begin to undermine the risk-based nature of the AML program. And frankly, as we talk about principles-based regulation now, AML is one of the few areas where it really is supposed to be risk-based, principles-based. The reason I think in part we're not seeing that is the kind of second-guessing that goes on when there's a problem, when the risk occurs and you have a mishap in an institution. Now, in some cases, that institution had no systems and it's a meltdown. But what happens is it doesn't get communicated well to the regulators and to the institutions, so that all institutions feel like, well, it's risk-based, but it isn't really, because if I miss something, I'm going to get second-guessed after the fact and told that I did my risk calculus was wrong. And so I think finding ways, I'm not a proponent, I'm speaking personally, not for my institution and not for my industry, but personally I'm not a proponent of safe harbors, because my feeling is if the government has to set safe harbors, they're going to set the level, the bar is going to be so high that it's going to rob institutions of flexibility, actually. But what I am in favor of is a truly risk-based system where institutions, if in light of the knowledge they understood at the time they made their decisions, made a reasonable decision, they don't get second-guessed. And frankly, the examiners don't get second-guessed for allowing them to do that. Because if we don't fix that piece of it, then the examiners are going to force the institutions into more rigid programs. And when you get rigid programs, what you get is multi-million-dollar transaction monitoring systems that are spitting out thousands and thousands of alerts a week that are not resulting in the identification of suspicious activity. But then the institution can say, I monitor all my transactions all the time.
Victor.
Victor Comrades Consultant. The United States is one important segment of the international financial market, and there's so much out there beyond our own borders. I wonder if you could extrapolate from your remarks and give us a sense of what's going on internationally. How are other institutions in other countries coping with these issues? Where do we stand in relation to them, and how much of the problem is beyond us because it's outside our borders?
I think that's a great question, and the problem is beyond us. Without effective international cooperation, the system, the United States can't fix all this by itself. Maybe there was a time when we could. We had such supremacy in terms of the financial markets. Now we don't. And there's intense competition out of UK and now Dubai and Singapore and other areas, so that it's got to be a multinational effort. It's interesting. Working Merrill, unlike some other companies, we're really pretty much all over the world now, but we're very integrated, even our foreign subsidiaries. So we apply the economic sanctions programs and the AML programs globally. Having said that, we also have to comply with the programs in the jurisdictions in which we operate. And in some cases, those jurisdictions, for example, the EU on beneficial ownership, is much better than the United States. And it's an opportunity, the way I like to leverage that is it's an opportunity to take the principles that we're developing for our companies in the UK and the EU and import them back into the US so that while we can move best practices from the US outward, in some cases now I have the opportunity to move them into the US. I think the biggest problem I'm seeing internationally is that you're seeing jurisdictions now, and this is, I think, through the FATF efforts, that have all the right laws and regulations on the books, but are just not enforcing them, and probably don't know how to. And in many cases, they actually, their laws are impossibly burdensome. And that's the worst thing you can possibly do, because then you encourage noncompliance. And in some cases, there are jurisdictions where U.S. companies have approached the regulatory authority and said, for example, your CIP rules are overly burdensome. We cannot comply with them. And the response they get is, do what everybody else does. Wink, wink. And by the way, if you tell me you can't comply, I'm going to come out and do an enforcement action on you. So I think where we've got to get is where, I always knew FATF was important, but I realize now it's even more important than I had thought. It's sort of done that first job of getting standards out there. Now what we have to really do is find a way internationally to really make those standards match and begin to communicate better. I mean, certain jurisdictions communicate pretty well with the U.S., others don't at all. It's not really clear that some jurisdictions, Matt makes a good point. Egmont let Syria have an FIU in Egmont. I personally do not believe that Syria is committed to counterterrorism and anti-money laundering. So
don't go on the limb now.
So what do you do when now essentially they've got an FIU that's part of the Egmont network, and you may want to share information among your Egmont members. You certainly don't want to share it with Syria because your fear is, well, they'll just use it to circumvent whatever systems you're trying to develop. So, if your point is that we can't do this without an international consensus and cooperation, it's a great point and it's absolutely right.
Yes.
Hi, Olivier Guittard from the counterterrorism newsletter, The Croissant. Quick question for you. One of the hottest terrorist spots in the world, Algeria, has passed very tough money laundering laws in 2004. After 3 years, only 12 inquiries were made. At the same time, a lot of European banks are doing business in Algeria. Deutsche Bank just announced that they were going to open offices there. Algeria is also troubling because of drug trafficking and money laundering. What do you think we can do to force the government to enforce the good laws that they have?
Your question's good, and you're giving me an opportunity to get on my soapbox, because it's not just Algeria. There are a number of countries now that are very attractive as emerging markets, and not just European countries, but U.S. companies want to do business there. But the problem is they don't want to have a they want the governments to enforce the regulatory regime so that they can actually do the business and do it safely. And it's very difficult to form the cost-benefit analysis. I think those countries, rather than we need to find a way, either through the UN or through FATF or through the international financial institutions that can play a huge role. You talk about the IFC or the IMF, to force these countries to start doing what they're supposed to do and to hold them accountable. I mean, I would personally, again, getting back to Egmont, I would like to see Egmont kick some countries out of Egmont. I think there are some countries that if you look at their, if you look at actually how they're implementing their anti-money laundering and terrorist financing laws, they do not deserve to be in Egmont, and instead of tolerating it and warning them and wagging fingers, they should be kicked out. And I think that's the only way to really bring about change in those countries that are simply not implementing the regimes the way they should. Does that answer? I hope I answered.
I have a follow-up. But, you know, it doesn't prevent companies such as Deutsche Bank to get into the country while they know that they're not going to be having regulators enforce their money laundering regulations.
Okay, so your question's a little, you're throwing it back on the private sector a bit too. And, okay, reputational interest. Deutsche Bank, they have to care about their reputation. So if they're operating in jurisdictions where we think bad things are happening in their banks, that I would advocate that public exposure of that would be the most effective way to deal with that.
Yes, over here.
Yeah. Hi, Alpina Shaw with the IFC. Bob, I'm just wondering your thought about this information sharing and cooperation and putting your reputation at stake. We've got FATF, we've got the Egmont Group. Are there any private sector international bodies that, you know, I know with the environmental sustainability principles, we had a bunch of the Equator principles that were signed on by 20 big banks, or I don't know what it is now. Are there any similar things, or do you see? It's something I was thinking about being in an international organization.
There really, there's things like the Wolfsburg Group, where I actually just attended that for the first time. It was a couple of weeks ago. They're beginning to turn into forums where institutions can honestly share issues and what they think are effective or not effective about their programs and what they want to think they can do about them in a forum where it's what's said in Wolfsburg stays in Wolfsburg, and that's a healthy environment to create because it leads to more honest exchange, and then people begin to see, okay, I'm not the only one with that problem, because there's always that fear that you're the outlier. Everybody else has it solved, and you're just the one that can't figure it out, so you better not say anything, and then it's like the emperor has no clothes. You say, well, but my system doesn't work. Does yours? Oh, well, it works pretty well. Well, how many alerts do you generate? Well, 10,000 a week. And how many SARs do you file? Well, I didn't file any last year. So does your system really work? No, you know what? It doesn't really work. So and it gets pretty healthy because then you can begin to address programmatic issues. But what we don't really have is a way to share actual information. So that's something, I mean, there's a fraud net, there should be an AML net, there should be a CFT net, there should be ways that institutions can share it. But again, I think for the AML, that could be pretty effective, and that's right, I guess you gotta get around the legal issues. I would love to be able to post, some of the due diligence reports we get on prospective clients that we choose not to do business with. I'd love to make those available to other people. And have access to theirs, but we seem to be far away from that. Government sponsorship of that kind of a database, I think, or even international financial institution sponsorship of that would be useful. I think it might get a jump started.
Mike, come back. Talk loud. Can you hear me?
I can.
You talk a lot about the private sector and the problems in identifying and combating terrorist financing. Do you think the same problems apply and the same model applies when you're talking about implementing the Iran sanctions, the Sudan sanctions? Is that pretty much the same model could be applied, or the private sector does better at that, or are there different problems?
I think I have a twofold answer to that. I think country programs are actually a lot easier for the private sector to implement. And OFAC in general, restrictions are easier to implement, although you get situations where, particularly with unilateral programs, where you try and respect the U.S. sanction and you then get yourself crosswise with an anti-embargo law in another jurisdiction, and that can be rather challenging. But I think in general, we can train our people. We can test for that. We can have systems to screen payments. So those are pretty effective. But when you move into areas like the WMD program, that gets a lot harder. Because when you list a company, okay, we got that. But we know that a lot of those companies then are going to create an intermediary to do that business for them. And that's where it gets very difficult for private sector, even when you're doing due diligence on your companies to figure out, is this company okay or not? Generally, the company looks okay. They're doing legitimate transactions. And it's hard to know that, actually they're not okay because if you could manage to get three layers down, you'd see that they've got a company that does business directly with, the Iran Atomic Energy Agency or some clearly bad guy who's on the list who you're not going to do business with. So it is challenging when you get into some of the list-based programs.
Jess?
Thanks. Jess Sadik. I have two questions. First of all, I was wondering if you could comment on legislation in the Congress now to require that financial institutions divest themselves of money invested in Iran and protecting the officers of financial institutions from doing so. And also, other than sanctions enforcement, I was wondering if financial institutions can have any persuasive power over governments that finance terrorism. Can they, they're banking in these countries, they're doing other business transactions. Do they have any persuasive authority over these governments to change their behavior?
I'll take your second issue first. I think the answer to that, I think financial institutions would argue yes, that by bringing best practices to those countries, we can influence the way they do business. But having said that, as a practical matter, and this gets back to this gentleman's question about whether it's Deutsche Bank or any other institution, if the playing field's not level, you can be at a huge competitive disadvantage. So, again, sometimes you're faced with the decision, am I going to do no business in that jurisdiction because I can't compete, or am I going to get into that business, do appropriate risk-based analysis, but be less self-righteous in terms of the way I deal with that regime. In general, I think, again, my experience with my company is we're pretty conservative. If we can't document that we've done everything we need to do to stay out of a jurisdiction, we won't go into it. To mitigate the risks of a jurisdiction, we won't go into it. But unfortunately, there are institutions that will, and your business folks, boy, you should hear, I have to hold the phone out here because they'll be telling me the number of extremely renowned institutions that are doing business in that jurisdiction, and my response is, are any of them U.S. companies? And the answer is no. And that's the standard we apply, but as I think the Secretary of the Treasury has noted, it is putting us at a competitive disadvantage. The playing field is not level. And there's a lot of business we don't do and don't get because we're not willing to compromise standards that others are. And that's where I think, we need more stories that highlight who's doing what and why and where and how. and we need more real enforcement in jurisdictions that have the right laws on the books, but don't do what they say they're going to do. With respect to your first question, again, I understand the point of the legislation, but there are so many countries that do business, so many countries that do not particularly discourage doing business with Iran, and so many businesses out there that do business with Iran in one form or another, that if you do that to U.S. companies, you're going to accelerate the competitive disadvantage we're already beginning to see, because you're going to knock them out of doing business. We look at our clients, and if they do above a certain percentage of business with Iran, from a reputation standpoint, they're not going to do business with Iran. But if we knocked out every client that has a link somehow to doing business with Iran, we would be knocking out an awful lot of clients.
Just following up on your last remark, lack of consequences reputational interest. I just wanted your reaction to an observation that really there's very little that's being done to challenge international financial institutions in terms of consequences or reputation. But don't we seem to whitewash too often what's happening internationally? For example, the FATF itself with its NCCT list is down to narrow, and I think now is about to, or just has gotten off. So we're telling the world that everybody's doing a good enough job. Shouldn't someone be telling the world that they're not doing a good enough job?
I'm going to go out on a limb and agree completely with you. I actually think that if we have international organizations like FATF, like Egmont, and they don't actually police their membership in a really disciplined way, they can end up being worse for good practice than better, because you get a certification, you get a veneer. As you said, people assume, okay, everything's okay. And I think there's jurisdictions out there that clearly have FIUs in Egmont or clearly members in FATF that aren't doing an adequate job. Now, maybe the counter to that is, well, you've got to draw them in first, get them to begin to develop the infrastructure. If you push them away, you isolate them, they'll never change. I'm just not very sophisticated about things like that. I'll leave that to Dave Nelson and others who understand how to do that. But my instinct is, okay, you can do some of that. Bring people in, be a little lenient as they're building their systems. But at the end of the day, if they don't get there within a reasonable amount of time, you should bounce them right back out. And that way people understand, okay, you're a FATF member, it actually means something beyond just that you've got the right laws on the books. And by the way, you better be implementing those laws, and the FATF assessments are coming around, and they're going to evaluate you, and you're not just going to get a nasty little note in your file, but you're actually going to be at risk of getting booted. People will begin to enforce those provisions. And frankly, being a U.S. company that globalizes our U.S. compliance requirements, I'd love to see that.
Yes, in the back.
Hi, Jonathan Obey of the House Financial Services Committee. You mentioned that most of the valuable SARs, from your perspective, come from either heavy criminal blatant criminal activity or subpoena. And you also mentioned that currently, FinCEN has so many SARs that they can't get through all of them or make sense of all of them. Do you have any recommendations of ways that we could increase the value and decrease the number of that?
Yeah, and I should clarify that comment. That comment was really directed at terrorist financing SARs. Most of the SARs that FinCEN receives aren't terrorist financing. They're money laundering, they're structuring, they're mortgage fraud. And most of those are perfectly legitimate SARs to be filed and used. It's just that they're not assisting in the counter-terrorist financing effort. Having said that, the answer is yes. On the counterterrorism side, I think we could increase the number of a valuable SARS file by increasing the knowledge base and awareness of institutions in terms of what they're looking for. At this point, we all have the red flags, and the government's worked very hard to publicize those. But the problem with the red flags is when you build out a scenario that takes into account the red flag, it also mimics legitimate commercial activity. And none of us have figured out a way to really sort our activity so that we're just generating alerts on truly illicit activity. And with terrorist financing, I think the only way to really do that is to focus on the relationships that the people know are out there. Once you know the relationship, I mean, there's folks in this room who know this far better than I do. But once you've got the relationship, then the money does really help you build out the nodes and the networks, and you can expand because you know these guys are bad, and then when you figure out who else they're related to financially in terms of the transactions they're doing, you find out a lot of other bad people you didn't know about. And that's information that the private sector has that it doesn't know it has, but it could feed to the government. And, you know, I think unfortunately, we're losing that opportunity because there just isn't that either its level of trust or maybe there are legal impediments, but there isn't that kind of exchange right now going on.
Can you just speak into the mic?
So is the private sector really after lists of names of corporations and individuals that might be in these relationships?
That's part of what they're after, and that's part of what I understand maybe going on in the UK now, where they've got lists that are not—they're not public; they're private lists that they are sharing with the private sector. I don't think that's necessarily the total answer, because what you don't want to have happen is the private sector to think that, okay, so now I've got the real list. And if the entity's not on the real list, I don't need to worry about it. It has to be clear that these aren't exclusive, that they're attempts to help you understand more who's out there. I think also coming and having the public sector feel comfortable coming to certain private sector institutions and saying, you know what, this isn't an issue of lists, this is an issue of region. We think there's a lot of really bad stuff going on here through gold in this area, or through oil trading. And we're not really sure how they're doing it, but if we can look at, here's the kind of activity we think you might see, why don't you look and see what you've got. Private sector guys go back and they look through, they focus on that industry and those transactions in a way they wouldn't have otherwise. And lo and behold, they see something, come back to the government and say, you know what, it's not what you thought. Matt, you directed us there, we looked, but it's actually not happening the way you think it's happening. We're seeing some weird stuff here. Why don't you come look at it? And that sort of back and forth that really, really just doesn't go on. It doesn't happen.
So these would be kind of like undesignated designations coming out of the government?
Well, that's the risk, that they're treated as designations, and maybe it's the practical consequence, but I think they wouldn't be designations. People would understand. These are people we're concerned about. What can you tell us about it?
But without the supporting giant intel package that goes along with...
Well, the private sector never sees that giant right. intel package. In fact, if the private sector did, it would be useful, because then we'd know...
Don't hold your breath.
Yeah. Then we'd know, okay, Cotty was designated, but guess what? There's like 15 other people he's doing business with that are just as bad, but weren't targeted for whatever reason publicly, whether it's political, covert activity, there wasn't enough evidence. And the private institutions could look at what activity they're seeing in relation to those people and maybe feed back information to the government that could be used productively.
When we think about the concerns people have about the due process and the ability to appeal designations, when we get to these lists, it takes it to a whole new level.
Yeah, but the notion that the government's sharing that kind of information with the private sector all the time, just very tactically on one-off cases.
Yeah.
Every time we get a grand jury subpoena, that's really no different. And so I think that if the answer is, well, you know, the private sector will take action in a way that will cause consequences to people that we think is unfair. Okay, that's a policy decision that can be made and maybe legitimately. But all I'm saying is if that's the position we take, if that's the approach we take, really don't look to the private sector to be a substantial contributor to the counterterrorism.
Yes.
Jason Blake from the from Business Executive for National Security. And I guess on that point, following that point, with respect to the domestic regulatory regime here in the U.S., is there something that maybe perhaps it's from your top 10 things you learned or but a single best practice from the private sector that could result in more of a tangible, immediate impact and improvement, I guess, of the financial regime, regulatory regime we have here?
Yeah, I think my own focus and what I've been trying to develop support for among my colleagues is to really look at how we're using these transaction monitoring systems, because I think the way we're using them now and the way we're, frankly, the regulators expect to use them is really damaging our programs because we're misallocating resources right now.
Let me ask one last question, which I have had for a while, but there were so many other questions I awaited. When we get into the kind of proliferation side and we're looking at Iran, one of the things that I hear a lot from the private financial sector is concern about the fact that on the one hand, our smart sanctions, our new targeted financial measures are just that. They're targeted, focused on specific illicit actors engaged in illicit conduct, trying to change behavior, et cetera, et cetera. And that, they tell me, they can deal with because I'm telling them, look for that guy or that company. But then the Treasury Department goes out and meets with them privately and says, but actually it's the entire jurisdiction of Iran, and here's some declassified information in one of these one-off exchanges we can give you about the nature of that regime. For example, the fact that it engages in deceptive financial practices, so that if all we did is give you names of individuals and companies, you wouldn't hit it all because they're engaging in deceptive financial transactions in a way that you wouldn't. And they're very, very concerned about that because that's pushing them to go far and beyond what even you, the government, are willing to do in your targeted financial measures.
Yeah, I think it's a problem to go to an institution and say, we've designated specific people, but really you can't do any business with them. And that's not the kind of information exchange I'm actually advocating.
I imagine.
But I think that does, I've heard that that's going on too. I have not personally witnessed it, but I've heard.
Part of my answer, I'll tell you, because I'm sought out on this now that I've left government as well, is I say, look, the government's not pressuring you not to do business with them, actually. What the government's trying to do is to provide information based upon which you can make informed decisions. And if market forces are such, because of due diligence and reputational risk and fiduciary obligations to shareholders, are such that you're going to end up having to go farther than the government is able to go, that may be the case. But don't blame the government for providing information that market forces then push you to go in a direction you don't want to go on.
I think that it depends how it's presented. I agree. If it's presented in the spirit of sharing information that doesn't rise to the level of allowing official government sanction, but from a business perspective, you might not want to take the risk. That's one thing, and it may put an institution in the position of making some hard choices. But if it's put in the context of we haven't gone this far, but if you're either with us or against us, right, that's a different story, and that puts an institution in a really precarious position.
I think that's part of why it's become so such a lightning rod, because I think the government has tried to present it as giving you information that you can make informed decisions with. On the one hand, and on the other hand, the government has also said, and follow these real carefully, because if you continue to do business with Iran even after we've informed you of all these risks, you could be next.
Right, and that... That would actually completely destroy any opportunity to do what I'm advocating we do, which is have a true sharing of information among government and private sector entities in an honest and trusting way. That's a covert sanction program. It's under the surface saying, by the way, we haven't said this publicly, but you better not do business with those people.
Sometimes we've even said it publicly. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming. Bob, thank you so much for taking the time. This is a very, very useful session. Thank you.